Hey guys, welcome to another episode of the David Mead Podcast. Today, I spoke to Adam Walsh. Adam Walsh is a name you're probably not too familiar with, but he plays a very important role, not just in my life, but in the lives of many other athletes. Walshy is currently the welfare officer at the Brisbane Broncos, which means he has to look after all the boys and make sure their mental well-being is in good shape. He's also a former SAS soldier. During this interview, I spoke to him a lot about the lessons he's learned and how he applies them in his day-to-day life. I certainly learned a lot from Walshy, and I hope you guys do too. All right. Walshy, welcome to the David Mead Podcast, mate.
Thanks, matey. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for making time. So I know you as the welfare officer here at Broncos, and I know a little bit about your army background. I saw a little bit of it a couple of years ago at Inaugura there. I saw how respected you were amongst your peers with the guys there. So, you know, I thought it'd be an interesting chat with you to see if there's some lessons that you can teach us about, you know, being in the army, what you enjoy doing here at the Bronx. But firstly, can you just tell us a bit about your background and where you grew up?
Yeah, definitely. I actually grew up down your neck of the woods, mate. So Lismore area. I was born in Lismore, which is northern New South Wales. My family are cane farmers from down Wardell area. I did my schooling in Austinville. We actually lived on a small farm in a township called Wallingbar. I did my high school in Woodlawn, St. George College Woodlawn. I was a boarder there. I was very fortunate enough to do year 10 overseas as an exchange student to Argentina. I came back and did my 11 and 12 in Ballina at Southern Cross. Growing up, obviously, you know, northern New South Wales, it's a great spot. I had a really blessed childhood. There was some friction in the family, though. My family did suffer from domestic violence. And probably looking back, Dad was probably an alcoholic, so that was a sort of a burden on the family in many regards. And that sort of really sort of shaped, I guess, how I ended up becoming in my role. It really affected me, my childhood. And, when I was in year 11 and 12, I actually lived by myself in Ballina. So I had to deal with a lot as a young fella, but also what I went through really helped me and put me in good stead to what I'm doing today and also in my army career.
You mentioned a little bit about your, you know, life growing up in Lismore. I actually moved to Lismore when I was 12 years old from PNG. Yeah. So I know a lot about Lismore. It's a good spot there.
Yeah, it's a beautiful spot. Yeah, it's especially Ballina, the close to the beach, it's a great spot to live. Like I said, we've got the cane farms down near the beach there in Wardell Broadwater. So a great spot, great part of the world.
You mentioned I was going to ask you about a few struggles. You obviously mentioned, you know, with the growing up and stuff like that. You know, what were some of the positives that come from that or that you experienced during childhood?
Yeah, I guess, you know, as I said earlier, when I came back from in year 10 overseas, a lot of memories of my childhood and what I witnessed sort of festered up and probably when I was 16 years of age. And I had a falling out with my father. I couldn't live with my mother. And I actually remember having a sort of family meeting when my parents were separated, and I realised I was in Ballina sitting in a picnic bench then outside the RSL, and I realised I had nowhere to go. I went and bought the paper and found a room to rent in East Ballina, and I just had to forge my own way. So the rent was $120 a fortnight. I was earning $130 a fortnight. So I lived off Weet-Bix and cereal for a couple of years. And my mum would come down from Lismore and buy me some groceries here you know, every now and then. But me going through that really sort of forged my independence, made me resilient, made me who I am today. So I think that's the way I look at it. Now I went through a bit my childhood, but I'm glad I went through it because I could have either went the other way, probably like my sort of sister did, you know, and sort of went down the victim and drugs, and I understand why she went that way. But for me, it was I just chose to sort of use it as a positive and get on with my life.
How old were you then?
So I was 16. I think when my mother and father separated when I was 9, but there was sort of years of domestic violence and you know, emotional sort of trauma leading up to that. So, it did really affect me. And I think I probably still didn't really deal, I guess, with my own childhood trauma until I was sort of 27, which I've spoke before openly amongst the group. You know, obviously, at 27 years of age, I was carrying a pretty big burden around on my shoulders, and I finally had to let a lot of stuff go in my life that was affecting me, and to do with relationships and, you know, non-attachment and, you know, anger. But, you know, I put, you know, like I said, it sort of made me who I am today, and I'm really glad I went through that, to be honest.
Yeah, definitely. You know, with the domestic violence stuff, I can relate to that story a lot because, you know, I grew up witnessing a lot of that as well. But, you know, we'll chat about that a little bit down the track because I think that's an important chat to have. I'd definitely love to speak to you about that. Also, just while we're talking about your childhood growing up, you mentioned you were earning $130 a week paying for rent. What was your first job? That was your first job?
Yeah, no. So I got work at in Ballina. It was a retail shop called Fair Dinkum Bargains. It was like I guess reject shop now, I think they call it. So I was working there on Thursday afternoons and I think Sundays as well, just to get some money to pay for the rent and pay some food. And I was playing a lot of sports, so I was having to juggle between sports, school, and putting myself through school in year 11 and 12, and obviously earning some money to pay the rent and put food on the table. And looking back now, it's funny, I'm a father now, and I sort of, there's no way I'd want my son to go through that and experience that. But I guess when you're in the, you know, when you're in the washing machine, you're doing it, it's life, you know, and, you know, there's other people in this world who've had harder lives than mine. I've had a blessed life, I really have. And like I said, and I continue to say it, that it's all a bit of perspective, and I'm really lucky to experience that and come to the other end. And it's funny, a couple of weeks ago, I think I was doing a talk and someone asked me that Triple H and hardships and, you know, and highlights. And for me, one of my highlights in my life is actually surviving that and doing that. I look back and sort of got to pat myself on the back there for going through that and being able to grow as well as a person. I never sort of gave up. And once again, probably why I filtered through and made it in the SAS and what I'm doing here now as well.
Were you a rugby league fan? Did you play it?
Yeah, I played it. Lacking one thing, that's probably talent. I love rugby league. I have, you know, ever since I was, you know, well, I can remember, yeah, loved the game, love what it means and represents. But yeah, unfortunately for me, I lacked any talent whatsoever.
What position did you try to play?
try more of a back row. I like to think of a raging back rower, but yeah, back row is sort of lock meaty. But as I said, I was never any good. So
yeah. So I want to talk a little bit about the army now. I don't know too much about the army or, you know, your experience in that. You know, I think hearing your the struggle that you went through as a kid, I'm sure that had a little bit to do with, you know, why you got the – I was going to ask you what made you decide to join the army.
Yeah, I sort of fell into the army, to be honest. I always was interested, and I remember in year 12 I was deciding whether to go to uni or – go to RMC or join the army. You know, I always on our farm we always had weapons, and my grandfather, who was an idol of mine, was in World War II. I had uncles in World War II as well. But yeah, I sort of fell in. I moved to Brisbane from Lismore after school and started some study, and I was doing accounting actually, and it just was not me at all. And I was broke. I decided to switch to psychology because I always had an interest in psychology, and I saw an advert. Join the Army Reserves, you can do it over the Christmas break, and I think you get about $2,000, $3,000, and this is in 2001. So I thought that would do me, I need some money, I'll just join the Army Reserves. Anyway, and once I got there, it was like I'd found home. You know, I craved structure, I'd been to boarding school, and you know, I was, you know, like I said, I love discipline. You know, and all you had to do was do your best, do it with controlled aggression, and you get rewarded for it. So for me, it was really easy. And while this struggled, I sort of lapped that up. It probably for me, it was something I craved as a young fella.
What was your first day like?
I think most people probably listening to this who joined the army probably have very similar experiences. I remember being flown from Brisbane down to Sydney, getting a bus to the training depot, Kapuka it's called in Australia, getting a bus ride there, then getting off the bus and just all of a sudden you step off the bus and just you hurled abuse and yelling and screaming and grabbing bags and being able to carry them in your left hand, not your right hand, and you know, getting your head shaved the next day. So, yeah, it was a whirlwind experience. Yeah, it wasn't too bad. Like I said, I craved it, to be honest.
What was the last day like?
It was a great time, actually. I was in Perth and we went up to the Grotto. It's a famous boozer or pub on base. And I had my squadron come up and pair me off and say their farewells. And it was a great time, but also a sad time. You know, I had to make the decision whether to stay on at the Broncos at that time or leave the army. And I chose to obviously leave the army. And it's been a part of my life for such a long time and given me so much, great friends, great experiences. You know, financial wealth and security. So for me, leaving was sad, but had to be done, and a new chapter of my life was about to begin with the Broncos.
When you did join the army, was the family supportive of you wanting to join? Or
to be honest, I'd been my own man for a long time, and mum and dad didn't really have too much to say. My grandfather, my pop, God bless him, as I said, he was in World War II. He was an American serviceman. When he found out I was joining, I remember he grabbed me and said, you know, it's great during peacetime, but just be really careful if you do go to war. And he hadn't been affected by his service. He'd seen a lot of service in the Philippines and Malay. And, you know, looking back now, Pop was probably – did have PTSD from his time in World War II, but hit it really well and never spoke about the army. He actually only spoke about his time in the army after I joined, to be honest, and that was with me. Yeah, so he sort of warned me a little bit, but as a family sort of unit, that they weren't really that interested, to be honest.
While you were during your time in there, were there any moments of doubt, fear, and
definitely.
How did you overcome them?
Well, probably, I had a couple of hairy moments in the SAS, in particular, sort of trip in 2011. So some near misses. The biggest thing that helped me was my mates. Nothing beats peer support and obviously the training. But I remember on one day we were pinned down on a ridge line. And I actually had the machine gun and there was, you know, little flicks of dust and rocks hitting up around me. And it was obviously the rounds coming in, the bullets. And I remember I yelled out to a really good mate of mine, you actually know Michael Green from War Ammunition. And I yelled out and I realised my voice had gone up. And obviously it was the fear in my voice. And as soon as I said it, I know, everyone's going to know that I'm shitting bricks here. I looked over and Greeny had this beaming smile on his face because he knew that I was scared, I was nervous. And, I couldn't take it back. I'm, damn it. So he knew I was scared and he was having a good chuckle about it, me screaming for ammunition. But, I think all the hairy moments I've had in particular with the SAS, I think – it's your mates and training will definitely get you through. But also at the time, you don't really have much time to think about it. You just do it. It's when you're back on the helicopter going back to base, you have time to reflect and the adrenaline dump happens where you sort of go, oh, wow, that just happened. That was a near miss. Now, and then you sort of get a bit trembly. Well, for me, myself, I got a bit trembly afterwards thinking that was pretty close. And especially when, you know, I've got young kids and so forth. At the time, it happened so quick. You just sort of, you know, I guess it's like when you play rugby league, you know, they bounce the ball, this happens, you don't have time to think about, oh, I'm going to have to have a hard carry run into some forwards, you just do it. That's very similar, I guess, on the battlefield and the things I've been exposed to.
What was the biggest lesson you learned while you were in the army?
The 1%ers count. The 1%ers mean everything. And I've actually spoken to this to our football team in the past. I think, the 1%ers, they're easy to do and easier not to do. And those choices, those daily choices you make, they all add up. I'll use diet, for example. Say you go right now and you have a Big Mac for lunch and that's all you have. You know, the first time won't affect you. The third time won't affect you. Probably the seventh time won't affect you. But, you know, if you do it over a month, 30, 40 days, it's the compound effects and it can affect you. And the flip side of that, sort of choosing the Big Mac or the Coke you chose for water and a salad the first day, won't see any difference. Third day, zero. The 30th and 40th day, they're going to say a huge difference. So I think for me, knowing the trust in the process, understanding why the training is really important and covering off on the one percenters has a huge impact in your life. And that's what I found. The army taught me really well, the discipline and staying at it, doing the one percenters. And one percenters, if for me, they're the difference between someone who's living, the best they possibly can, whether it be an elite athlete or, a mother. It's the one percenters, they're the difference between someone who's great and someone who's, ordinary, in my opinion.
I definitely agree with you. Spending 13 years at a professional level, you see the guys who are doing the one percenters, they're the ones who play for a very long time. So
yep,
exactly. It's definitely a huge lesson, that one. Do you use that lesson outside of the army as well on a day-to-day basis, or is there another lesson you learnt since you left?
I do. I really believe in the one percenters, and it's something which I preach. The Broncos, we do our under-16s character development camp every year, and that's something which I really hone in on. And likewise, as a father, I'm telling my son and daughter about the one percenters and why discipline and routine and structure is really important for someone's life. I think, the biggest thing I've probably learnt besides that is friendship. So for me, friends are really important for someone's connectedness and someone's mental health and well-being. But I've been really lucky to have some great friends, and I think a lot of people's downfall in their lives at the moment, especially young persons, is friend selection. And what I mean by that, Meaty, what I mean by friend selection is you've got to have a look at your friends, circle of friends and trusted group to see if they're actually enabling you. And you want a friend who makes you be a better person. You want someone who supports you when you're down. It's a no-brainer. But the biggest thing, I think, is having a circle of friends, close friends, who keep you accountable. And that's really important. And I'm really lucky from my time in the Army and the SAS. I've got a group of friends who do that. They make me a better person. They're supportive. But the biggest thing for me is they keep me accountable. And I've got some friends I speak to every day and constantly, what are you up to? What are you that for? Why aren't you training? Relationship advice, you name it. You've got to have that feedback. And that's probably the biggest thing one of the biggest things I've learned. Having really good friends. Some of the friends who don't give you those three elements in your life, you're wasting your time. They can't help you. And I'm a big believer. There's an old saying, show me your friends, I'll show you your future. I'm a big believer in that. So for listeners out there, I'll probably challenge you to have a look at your friends. And if they're not enabling you, supporting you and keeping you accountable, they're not really your friends.
Definitely. I like that, Walshy. We will talk about your experience in PNG, because I know there'll be a majority of the listeners will be from PNG, Pacific Islands, and here in Australia as well. But I'm sure they want to hear about your experience there, your 1 year that you spent there. But before we get there, life outside of the army, I spent 3 days there. And when I left, everything was easy. The camp we had, the Enogra, that was the hardest 3 days of my life. And then when I left, mate, doing anything around the house, whatever you call it, was just a breeze. Was that your experience as well?
Yeah, it definitely changes your perception and highlights how effective being an effective team member is, and having or working as a cohesive unit is. And those sort of army style camps we've run in the past for football clubs, that's the basis. I guess the foundation is you want people to come out of there knowing that what it is to be a team member. What it is, not to slacken off and actually help and contribute. But like I said, I think the army, for me, it's given me a great perspective on discipline and what discipline means. And it's funny, for me, I get asked all the time, from parents in particular, what is resilience? Like, you've been in the SAS for this life. What is it about, how do you become resilient or gain resilience, which can increase? And for me, the easiest way to become mentally tough and building resilience is doing your routine, your daily routine and processes. Is by fulfilling your routine, that's discipline. And the byproduct of discipline is mental toughness and resilience. So that for me is I keep on saying to parents, to young parents and to the kids, like, that, you know, that's why you've got to have routine in your life and in processes, because if you fold them down to a T, you get discipline, tick. Byproduct of discipline is mental toughness and resilience.
And everything else.
It just flows on from
flows
that.
Flows on, eh? Yeah. What's your advice for anyone looking to join or someone who's just started up, and you know, have you got any tips for them on how to progress well once they're in?
Yeah, I think it's a wonderful opportunity, wonderful career. I thoroughly enjoyed my time in the Defence Force and in the Army in particular. I think what I would like to tell young soldiers or people who want to join is go there with an open mind, be prepared to work really hard if you want to succeed, and just listen to the older soldiers who've gone before you, because they can obviously impart their knowledge. But also I'd probably say have an exit strategy. And what I mean by that is I think, you know, you join the Defence Force, job security and so forth, it's a wonderful career, but also have an exit strategy. And what that means for me is education is really, really important. I started studying in 2014, actually off Wayne Bennett's advice. Afghanistan, the war had rounded up, and I was getting bored. And he just said, mate, you've got to start studying. That's your exit strategy. Start studying, better yourself. So for me, it's a wonderful, safe employment, but use your time wisely, strive for personal development and growth while you're there.
I spoke to you briefly about your time in PNG, and you said you've got some good stories from there, so it would be great to hear about those. When did you go to PNG, and you know, what was your main reason for going over there?
Yeah, my first time in PNG was October 2009, actually. We went over there for the SAS patrol course, and we're based out of Lae, and I think we were there for 3, maybe 4 weeks that time. It was actually interesting. Getting over there was an interesting moment. We left Perth to go to Brisbane, then obviously Brisbane then to Townsville, then Townsville to PNG. And it happened to be on the grand final weekend. So we were pretty devastated we were going to miss the NRL grand final. Anyway, when we landed in Townsville, it was on the Friday, lo and behold, I think it was a C-130, it broke down. And it didn't break down, that the pilots understood and they wanted to watch the NRL grand final week as well, and they had the AFL. So it was grounded, and so we got called in. We got told you had some leave in Townsville and we could watch both the grand finals, and it was fantastic. So we were staying at Edinburgh there, the base. So we got on the beers, watched the grand final. But what we didn't realise is by us doing that, we missed a really important probably 4 days of acclimatisation in PNG, because obviously in Perth that time it's freezing, and you know yourself in Papua New Guinea, the humidity, especially up in Lae that time. So we I think it was on the Thursday, we finally landed in in Lae. We were thrown straight out in the jungle with no time to acclimatise, and just the heat and the sweat, and we went out patrolling in the hills of Lae, and it was tough. The first 3-4 days was really tough for us, but a great patrol course. We actually worked with the long-range reconnaissance units on the patrol course. We had those guys embedded in our patrols, and great fellas. And I worked a number of times post that with those guys from those units, and nothing but respect for them. But, yeah, that was 2009 in Lae. I then went back there in 2012. Once again, we're training the long-range reconnaissance unit at Goldie River Barracks there, actually, in Port Moresby. We were just training them for some counter-terrorism and some shooting. They ended up being there, I think we were about there for 4 months that time. I was very lucky. We stayed in Port Moresby for a good 3-4 weeks and travelled out to Mendi, Goroka, Mount Hagen. We went to Toofey, the dive resort in Toofey, and just absolutely loved the place. And like I said, the fellas there at Goldie River Barracks, great young men. Really good soldiers. They're amazing trackers, living off the land. They taught us a lot, especially in our patrol course. Amazing trackers. They can track through the jungle and what they see. And, yeah, fond memories there. And then I went back there in 2015, actually. I spent another sort of 3 and a bit months based at a Gold River Barracks, once again training LRU, and that was for the APEC. They had APEC in 2018, I believe it was, and we were there in 15, trying to train their skill sets up so they can handle the counterterrorism role. I mean, yeah, like I said, they're great soldiers. Great soldiers. The whole barracks were really accommodating. And I remember fond memories. There's a couple of patrol commanders there, Eddie, George and Stephen. And a couple of times the lads took us out to nightclubs and went to Illusions nightclub and Gold Bar. There was a heap. I think it was Armani was another one. And, yeah, we had, you know, I got really fond memories. I told you before, Mitty, I love Papua New Guinea. I love the culture. I love the people. And I've got so many fond memories. I think I've probably as well just coming from the Defence Force and World War II, everyone's sort of heard of, you know, Kokoda and just what both our countries went through and, you know, fighting the Japanese. And like I said, I've got an uncle, Australian uncle, who fought in Kokoda, was in World War II. And so for me personally, I think there's a strong bond there and connection. I think, you know, to be honest, my opinion, I think Australia probably was really slow to sort of recognise the war effort and what Papua New Guinea helped us and the way they contributed to it to the war. And I think I read somewhere a long time ago there was about 10,000 Papua New Guinean civilians who helped Australians as porters and carriers, which is, you know, it's amazing, you know, and risked their own life and their own villages. But none of that, there's, you know, the warriors themselves. You know, there's a, correct me if I'm wrong, someone probably will listen, I think there was 2 battalions up there, and there's a load of you know, Papua New Guinean warriors who were awarded medals, and it's amazing, amazing acts and deeds of heroism behind the lines to help Australia, and not many people sort of recognise that or aware of that. So for me, I've got a strong connection there for my background. Love the people. I think, you know, it's funny, you sort of ask me why I like PNG. I think it's the culture's deep culture. I find the people really fascinating. I find them really welcoming, and you know, I love being up in Mount Hagen. I love being in Goroka. Just the people, yeah, they're genuine. You know, and you know, I think also just the harsh environment they live in, you know, just makes them tough people as well. And I think you see that when they play football. I love watching the Hunters. I love watching the Kumuls. You know, when you get, I think that's a reflection of who they are as a people. You know, they're tough, they're resourceful. Yeah, like I said, I think about admiration. I love the country.
Now, interesting hearing about the, you know, war and stuff like that. It just made me think I need to do a bit more homework on it and, you know, appreciate the efforts that, you know, those guys went through.
Yeah, definitely. And yeah, probably another thing I'll probably mention is I love going to Bomona Cemetery. Bomona Cemetery in the outskirts of Port Moresby. And in 2015 I was there. It was the 100th anniversary of World War One, Anzac Day for us, and I was happened to be in Port Moresby. And it was a really great experience. I think I took the Broncos boys there in, I think it was 2018, to Bomona. And Bomona Cemetery is a beautiful spot. But they've got 2 VC winners there. They've got Artie, I've written down here actually, Artie Cornwell. He was actually an NRL player or a first grade footballer for North Sydney, actually buried there as the fullback. He died in World War II. So there's a lot of heritage there. There's, I think there's one of the youngest in the cemetery is a 14-year-old boy, a Papua New Guinean boy who was a porter. You know, so as you see, yeah, you know, I love it. And I've got a deep rooted connection there and nothing but admiration.
Were you there mainly with you know, SAS the whole time? Have you ever been there? Just on like a outside of work, so to speak.
No, I haven't. I'd love to go up there. I've been there 3 times with the SAS, and then once with the Broncos. I would love to go back up. I've actually got a really good friend of mine, by the name of Louis Marimba. He lives at Goroka, and I've been meaning to go up and visit him there. I'd love to go back. I'd love to be honest, one day take the club back to Port Moresby and spend some time. Probably helping the communities and you know, helping community engagement. I think it would really be beneficial for everyone involved. And you know, I think in particular PNG as a whole is an untapped resource, football resource. And I'd love to get the club to go up there and do a bit of scouting, but also help the communities. I think it'd be really beneficial. I think we've spoken before, yep, previously, many years ago, about doing something up there. And I know the Bulldogs have done it, you know, the Sharkies have done it. I think for us it'd be great as a club to get up there and help and contribute in some way, but also and give back to the football communities up there.
Yeah, for sure, mate. I'm keen to do the Kokoda. I haven't done that yet, so yeah, let's tee that up.
Yeah, yeah, 100%. Yeah, and some of the listeners out there, if any listeners are out there and would like to, if they've got a business, you know, to sponsor and support, I think it'd be fantastic to get some Broncos players up there on their time off to give back and, you know, maybe run some clinics and do something with communities. I know the Sharkies, I think they went up there and installed solar panels for villages, I think they did, and maybe wind turbines for electricity. And the Bulldogs, I think they're up in one of the islands, maybe New Britain or New Ireland, doing they built a school. So I'd love to do a project with that with the Bronx. So if there are any businesses or listeners out there with the resource or got some ideas, maybe get in touch with the media and we'll try to make something happen.
For sure. We'll leave some notes at the end of the podcast for, you know, anyone wanting to get in touch. Did you learn any tokpisin at all?
I did. I went live. Can't remember much of it. That was in 2009. Yeah, no, just simple phrases, but no, I'm not fluent and I dare not try now because I'll embarrass myself.
I know you mentioned a few things that you liked over there, but what was your favourite thing about PNG?
That's a real tough one. Probably the smiling faces, mate. Like I said, I had a great time working with the Goldie River Barracks there with the soldiers of Long Range Reconnaissance Unit. They're just great blokes, good people, good people, genuine people.
Yeah,
That's what I like about it. And I said before, it comes into culture and, you know, the people as a whole. I had a ball up there. So much fun.
Yeah. Yeah, I know what you mean about the smile. You know, when we go into camp for the Kumuls, you know, the bus is driving from the hotel to the stadium and, you know, you look around and everyone's just smiling, waving, dancing. Like, you even look around and I see heaps of people just walking places, you know. So, you know, they move around a lot and, you know, there's a lot of smiling and you see a lot of happy faces there and it looks like there's not much there, but, you know, they're definitely people who are very rich in spirit. So.
Definitely, yeah. And that's, you know, that's what I think as well. Media, that's a really great comment you brought up is, you know, you sort of, you know, when you're there, you look around and you think, oh, they haven't got much and there's poverty in PNG, you know, but, gee, they're grateful for what they have got, their spirits, they're connected, their culture. Their family unit. You know, I remember last time I was there driving out to Gold River Barracks and we passed this patch of turf and it was all rocks and then these young kids are playing rugby league and I think they had a bundle of sticks wrapped up with it would have been like a rag or a shirt and that was the ball. And just seeing them having so much fun, it wasn't in football, but having so much fun and, you know, it's what you make of it. It's all about perspective, you know, and there's this genuinely happy people, you know, and that's, you know, their spirit is soaring. And I love that. I love going back there and seeing the people.
Yeah. We used to use an empty plastic bottle instead of a football if there wasn't one around. So, and you still see it going back there and you just, you know, every time I get there, I feel grateful for everything that you have here in Australia.
Yeah.
It's a great reminder. A little direction I want to go in was, you know, what you mentioned in your childhood growing up. This is something I've only spoken about briefly. I've written about it in, you know, 250, 300 words, which is not much. It was just me trying to bring some awareness about, you know, domestic violence. Mm. It's a big issue in Papua New Guinea. And how do I start this off? It's a conversation I've been wanting to have for years, but, you know, felt scared of how to express it because it's so normal over there. My experience growing up was, you know, this man bashed his wife and it's kind of just like spoken about the like
norm,
that, you know?
Yeah, the norm.
Yeah, it's just a normal thing to happen.
Social norm, yeah.
Yeah, so I want that perspective to change over there. I know it might take 10, 20, 50, 100 years, but I think starting the conversation now, and there are people in Papua New Guinea who are driving this issue. There's many people doing a great job over there. But I think as an athlete, there's, you know, there's power in what I have to say and what my teammates in the Kumuls have to say, what other athletes have to say as well. So, it's a conversation I definitely wanted to have at, on a podcast. I didn't expect to have it with you, but, you know, since you mentioned your childhood growing up and, you know, experiencing that type of upbringing, how do we cut it out?
Well, that's the million-dollar sort of answer there, isn't it? I think it has to start – it goes in generations, and I think educating young men in school between right and wrong is where we start. I think it's got to start, and I think to break the cycle, it probably needs people in communities, people like yourself, Mehdi, who are courageous enough to stand up and talk about their upbringing and how it affected them, going to schools and saying, you know what, this might be happening in your household, but it's not right. So when you become a leader of your household and everybody, you know, another thing I'm big on and for listeners out there is everybody is a leader. One day you're going to become a leader of your household and it's up to you to protect, provide and give safety and sanctuary to people in your household. And as a leader, you've got to, the buck stops with you. It's time to stop it. I think once they develop and young men develop and they realise that what they witness as a young fella isn't correct, then that's when we can change social norms. It's a bit like cigarette smoking. You know, it took the world, the Western world, 30 years to change the opinions of cigarettes. It's going to take, probably not the same time, I don't think not the same time, but it's going to take the same effort in advertising, speaking out, having community leaders talk out against domestic violence against women. It really, you know, I speak for myself, I said it earlier, you know, it took me until I was 27 years of age to deal with what I had witnessed, to unpack what was, and I stuffed up so many relationships, had attachment issues with relationships, had anger, you know, I wasn't a nice person, in my opinion, looking back, just because of what was happening with me, and I had to unpack a lot of stuff. So it'd be fantastic, especially in, you know, PNG, we can have a change of thought and behaviour towards domestic violence, because it's what you're talking about is social norms. It's just so accustomed. You know, it's ingrained now. It's you know, whereas, you know, it's you know, let's be honest, in Australia, I'm ashamed of what happened to my mum. You know, seeing your mother getting beaten and broken eye sockets and jaws, like, I'm ashamed, you know, and I think if we get that mentality in young communities or young men into communities, that's when we have lasting change. You know, and I think, yeah, awareness, just awareness and promotion of right and wrong.
Definitely. I think, you know, so as you're saying, I'm thinking like, you know, there's a young kid, he's 10 years old, he's got cousins living in the same house as him, and, you know, he's seeing his mum getting beaten by his drunk dad who's coming home after a Saturday night out. I saw a lot of this stuff growing up in the village. How does he gain the courage to, I wouldn't say speak up, because when I was growing up, when I saw this stuff happen, you know, it was never really right there in front of me. It was like kind of behind closed doors and yep. You could hear the noise. And then I'd be thinking, hey, what happened? And then the older I got, the more I realized, hang on, this is what was actually happening back then.
Yep.
And I just remember the times that, you know, that people in my family were hurt, you know, black eye, broken arms, that type of stuff. Well, the older I got, the more I realised it. So I'm thinking, like, me as a 7 to 12-year-old, you know, how do you – I know we said education. Mm-hmm. How does he approach it, you know? It's definitely a very hard
– Yeah, I think, yeah, that's – once again, it's hard to – everyone's different. I wouldn't burden a young 9 or 10-year-old boy and head to confront or speak to his father. I think this is something that socially is happening. You know, it's in families, it's in communities and villages. You know, those behaviours need to change. You can't be expected of a 10-year-old to approach the father. I think education of getting to understand right and wrong that, hey, that's actually not normal. That's what's happening. So when he's a young man, he won't, you know, do that to his partner is important. I think how to stop it right now in that aspect would be education, peer support, once again, getting role models in communities, speaking to young men or men in the villages about the impact this is happening. You know, I know, speaking for myself, one of the reasons why it's a hard time with dealing with my childhood trauma was there's a guilt. There's when I was, you know, one of the last ever big fights my mother and father had. My mum had an eye socket and her jaw broken, and it happened in the family, and I remember in the family home. And I remember my sister and I ran out of the house on our farm. I bolted. I jumped on a horse and canted down the back of the paddock. And for 18 years, I held that guilt and shame, wishing I'd stayed and actually fought my father. What I could have done as a 10-year-old or 9-year-old boy against my father was 6'3", nothing. So I think for listeners out there, what's a 10-year-old boy supposed to do? Nothing. They should be put in that situation in the first place. What they need to understand is what's right and wrong. So when they are a leader in their household, that's not right. So I think flipping onto that, educate the community as well, get into schools, have good role models, have an open conversation. You know, I know we talk about it in team meetings or, you know, in pubs here in Australia, but having an open conversation led by someone who with substance and who is a leader in a village or in a town hall to actually talk about this is affecting our kids. It's not on. We've got to change. This social norm is not helping. You know, and whether we put, you know, caveats around alcohol and what's the triggers, that needs to be looked into as well. That's my opinion.
Mate, that's that's powerful what you're saying, because that, you know, there is talk about education and stuff like that, but I haven't met anyone who articulates it like that. So, you know, I appreciate you speaking on that, Walshy. Thank you.
That's right.
Okay, so your welfare officer role here at the club. Mm-hmm. How do you get the gig? And you know, you seem to enjoy doing it.
Yeah, I love it. I absolutely love it, Meaty. How I got my role is through Wayne Bennett, and I've been very fortunate to have known Wayne for about 15 years on a personal level. And I spent some time with him a week at St. George, the Knights, just as a mate coming along to have a look and review. And I ran an army style preseason boot camp in December 2014. Just when he came back to the Bronx after being at the Knights. And I remember I was running a stand on the camp, and I just mentioned to him that it was my first year of studying psychology, love psychology. I probably would like to be in sports psych later in the track, and that's all I said to Wayne. A couple of months later, he rang me up and said, "Oh, mate, I think I've got a job for you. I think I've got a role for you. So let's aim for you to come over in 2016, January 2016 from Perth." I had at that stage, like I said earlier, the Afghan war was well and truly wound up, and I was sort of looking for something different and invest some time in the family. And I had probably a year and a half with the leave saved up. So decided to come over for a year to see if I liked it, left the family in Perth, and later that year I had to make the decision to stay on, and I did. And I haven't looked back. I've had multiple roles. My first 3 years, I was a wellbeing manager and also the NYC team manager, which is the old under-20 system manager. And then 2019 and also last year, I was the team manager and wellbeing manager. So a dual role there. And with Kevy and Steve coming back, I've now pushed back into wellbeing education. But it's a fantastic role. I love the club, and I think – I use this saying, want to know the road ahead, so it's coming back. I think I can use my life experience in just growing up and what I've experienced, but also my what I've learned in Defence Force and also in education, obviously saying psychology, to really help and make an impact on young men's lives. And I think you're talking about domestic violence and so forth. Like, I think it's mental illness and childhood trauma is so prevalent through all societies. I look at our team on I think at the moment it's about 65% of our rosters experience childhood trauma. That isn't, they're not big numbers by any means. That is just purely a reflection of society. We're talking about changing people. I love my role because I actually get to have a tangible impact on young people's lives, and that's why for me I don't mind sharing my upbringing, especially for our under-16s players, because I know there's out of that sort of 20 or so in that squad, there's probably at least 6 or 7 of those guys who I can connect with and help them. And I don't want them to, you know, have to suffer of 7, 8 years of anger and remorse and shame. I'd rather identify it, nip it in the bud, and help them grow as people. So that's what I love about the role.
I never really thought too much about the welfare officer role until I, you know, started trying to think of how to ask you questions about, you know, what you're doing in the welfare officer role, and I probably only see a little glimpse of, you know, how important it is.
Yeah.
Just by hearing what you're saying there, have you got any? I know you spoke about you know the stats and you know how many kids you want to connect with and stuff like that. Have you got any advice for kids that are playing rugby league or, you know, sports in general? I know that's a pretty broad question, but how to, you know, kind of get past all that stuff, the childhood trauma growing up.
Yeah, I think it uses a fuel. I sort of said earlier, like I had a choice whether to sort of use drugs to cope with what I went through as a young fella. Like I could have went either way, to be honest. You know, and living by myself, I could have gotten into dope and marijuana and stuff. But I guess no matter what's happened in your life, you get to control the narrative. You either get to reframe it or refocus and use it for fuel, like I've done. And it's, you know, you can turn a negative into positive. So just because you're, you know, down your luck, you've had, you know, some things go against you, doesn't mean it's game over, and you can flip it on its head. And that's really important, I think, for young people to realise. Like, you know, like I said, I've had a really lucky life. I've a blessed life. You know, there's other people, listeners here, who've had way worse than me. But I think it's just the way they can reframe it and use that as a fuel. I think the biggest thing for young sports people these days is remember to have fun. It's really important. Good peer support, really good peer support. And once again, I'll go back to discipline, but like trust the process and routine. You know, it's if you're a young sports star and, you know, you're cutting laps in the oval, you're late night kicking practice, like just stick at it. The first month you won't see any difference. It's later in the track when you're doing it for 6 months and you've been training, you've been watching your diet. 2 and 1 percenters, they are the biggest key indicator of someone's going to make it in their life. And that's not in sports, that's across the board. If you're going to have a really good relationship, you have to invest in it, the 1%. If you want to be a teacher, if you want to be a doctor, across the board, the 1%, they mean everything. They prefer the difference between winning or losing, in my opinion.
I was going to see if you had any advice for the welfare officers who look after these guys. You know, I don't know if there's a different answer you can give to that, or, you know, they'll probably listen to that and go, okay, this is what I need to focus on.
I think with my role, or, you know, the wellbeing sort of space, the biggest thing is building a rapport and connecting with your people you're looking after, and the trust has got to be there. You know, and you've got to, yeah, there's a clinical side where, you know, counselling and treating and helping them, but I think at the end of the day, and you're not going to connect with everyone. That's the way it is. But you've got to be genuine who you are. Make sure the person understands that you love them and care for them, and you want to help them. And it's all about relationships. You've got to have the relationship, and don't be scared to show a bit of vulnerability. I think that's really important. And leaders and as well. I think you've got to be real and authentic, and that's what I try to be. I think most people know who I am and what substance and what kind of person I am, and they know what they're going to get. And they're going to get, I hope, or people say this about me, someone who they can trust and someone who will generally care and love them and try to help them.
Yeah. Well, vulnerability, that's a big one, because, you know, I didn't plan on speaking about domestic violence today, but, you know, because you opened up at the start, I felt comfortable enough to talk about it. So vulnerability, it's a superpower in my opinion. I'm still learning to be more vulnerable. The older I get, the more I realize that it's a strength rather than a weakness, and it's something that helps me connect with people.
100%. Now, and this is, I'll tell you right now, I've worked in elite teams in the SAS, elite teams where everyone's alpha male and we're all killers. You know, and we're all so focused. I've worked in this industry in elite sports, everyone, once again, alpha male in this gladiator sport, warrior sport. Every person who I've worked with in the SAS, or every morning when I see people walking here, when they walk through the door, they put a mask on. And I would love, it's my job to tear that mask off, and they might carry around for a wee bit and you know, and they want to hide themselves, but rip the mask off. You know, it's about being authentic. You know, and that, for someone who wore a mask for so long and got bloody heavy and had to take it off, it was a relief. You know, and I think, you know, talking, you know, being honest and talking about domestic violence or whatever you've gone through as a young fella, or you know, what you're experiencing right now in your working life or home life is really important. And that's why it comes down to your circle of friends you have. You've got to have someone you trust and you connect with. Once you find that circle and you can take your mask off, it's a huge relief. And it's vitally important. Yeah, I feel sorry for those people who go through their life for such a long time having to wear a big mask. And normally what happens in my experience of treating and counselling people this way is they're the ones who will use substance abuse, alcohol and drugs, you know, for a coping mechanism, for escapism and so forth, because they're just that mask is so heavy and they're damming it up. Yeah, rip it off, get treatment, go see a counsellor if you can, go speak to your family members if you have a good enough relationship, a close relationship or peer support. No, it's really important.
Well, she made that, that answer kind of answered my very last question that I had, because it was about, my bio was about, a kid who felt unstoppable about, having that dream, which was to play rugby league. But then into my teenage years in high school, I started to hear people saying, you need to make rep teams. You need to be big, you need to be strong, fast, all these things. I mean, they're not really negative, but they make you feel like, I'm not that right now. So, what chance do I kind of have? So it puts a little negative spin on it. And these are like conversations you hear from family, friends, people at the local footy ground. For me, in my early high school years and teenage years, those things started to put a bit of doubt in my mind. Where as a kid, I was like, yep, I can see them on TV. I'm going to play that sport one day. Zero doubt. In my teenage years, the doubts start creeping in. But then I speak about having a coach who helped me, instilled belief in me and told me to put the work in. And the reason why I'm doing the podcast is, how does a kid go from feeling the way they do? Maybe I was lucky and I just felt that. I know not every kid feels that. But then in their high school years, the doubt, fears, the blocks, they all start to seep into your mind. And I think by, doing this podcast, I think you've answered a lot of questions on how to overcome that. Is there any final words from me to how to overcome this? I think the mask analogy was a great one. Like, have you got any more advice on this?
Probably a couple of things. That one of the biggest impacts I'm seeing on not just young people's lives, but everyone's life at the moment is social media. And I really want to touch on social media because I know in Papua New Guinea in particular now it's pretty prevalent, and obviously branding and the way they're using social media. Social media, and it's been really well highlighted, it's a myth. It's a fake world. It doesn't exist. And let's just talk about social media first of all, the construct, and it's designed to keep you on engaged, and it's selling. It's a product. It's an entertainment product that's selling you advertising effectively. But also behind that, if you're, people posting photos and it's, like say, friends or people even stars placing photos or videos up there, and it's all fake. It's all staged. It's done for a reason. So I think for long as you realise that, you might be looking, I feel as though like I'm not worthy. Like these people are putting these photos on these destinations. But it's all rubbish. It's all fake. And I know plenty of people who I've counseled before who have Instagram accounts that have, amazing photos, and you look at the Instagram account and, well, they've made it, their life's amazing, but behind closed doors they're struggling. So it's a myth. So let's get out of the way. Another thing I'm seeing, especially in the sporting realm, is the effect of trolling that it has. So my advice to people who are trolling, but also people who are up-and-coming athletes or getting trolled, just understand that they wouldn't say it to your face, and it's make-believe, and it really, I hear people say, trolling, just turn it off, or just, don't use Facebook, don't use Instagram. I think people have to understand that people are using these platforms, young people now, to communicate. It's a different way to communicate, direct messaging through Instagram and so forth. They're always on it. They can stay connected. I've got no dramas with that, but when, I've had it just recently where a young player playing for the Broncos NRL had a average game, gets off the pitch and there's troll abuse, death threats. This guy's like 20 years old getting death threats.
Yep.
No one, so I think you've got a construct in your brain that people are trolling you. It's not real. They wouldn't say it to your face. So you've got to do the best, you block it out. On the flip side, if you're trolling, you know, I dare say your listeners wouldn't be doing this, but, you know, if you're trolling, just understand that I understand why you're passionate and your tribe and you want your team to go well, but at the end of the day, like, this person had a bad game. It doesn't mean they're a bad person. They didn't do this on purpose, but it's always hard to perform. And so probably understanding that, yeah, that it's a double-edged sword, social media. Great to communicate with your friends and stay connected, but it's just rubbish. It's a fake world.
Yeah.
You know, and the trolling hurts. And I know it's also steps into the boundaries of or the realm of online bullying and so forth. And here in Australia, we've got massive issues with online bullying. And I have no doubt it will take hold in Papua New Guinea as well. So I think understanding the constructs of it's all make believe, and people who are doing the trolling, who are they anyway? And that's so funny. I'll just talk about this quickly with your listeners. Like, I think in Australia and in Papua New Guinea, like this, everyone's so passionate about rugby league. Everyone's so passionate about supporting your tribe and your club, and it means everything. You know, I've been a One thing I love all about Papua New Guinea in particular is the Broncos jerseys and the Cowboys jerseys, and just everyone's so passionate. Now, just going quickly off topic, I remember 2012 going to Gold River Barracks, getting invited to watch the game the Broncos were playing, and I went into this little pub on base. There's one TV, it was probably 30 centimetres big, and there would have been 80 people around it watching it. They're so passionate, and I get it. It's fantastic. But when you work in the industry, and especially in my role, and you see a young athlete, a rugby league player, running out on a Friday night in Suncorp with, you know, 50,000 people cheering them on with high expectation, they want to see their tribe win, they want to see a game of football. But what they don't know behind that, what they see in that jersey is that week that person's gone through. And they might be dealing with, you know, relationship stress, financial stress. You know, a player's just been told their mother's got cancer. You know, mum and dad's just had a fight. Their brother's just gone to jail. They're dealing with personal demons themselves of depression, anxiety. And that for me is, I just wish that people would stop and actually realise that there's a human being running out in that field. It's for entertainment. But I that's one of the biggest things I guess I respect you guys so much, as I do know you. I know you, I do know what other players go through, and I don't look at you as a player. I look at you as a human being, and I sometimes wish, and I think we probably need to do a better job, to be honest, of athletes like yourself, what you're doing here, being genuine and being real, you know, and talking about their issues. And obviously everyone's got their own journey, you know, and people in their life cycle right now, you're happy to do a podcast and be vulnerable and talk about you as an either athlete and who is David and me as a person. But I think sometimes community members and fans forget that it's just entertainment. So just go easy on the trolling and the social media abuse, because you don't know what that person is going through. And my fear is one day it's going to tip them over the edge, especially if someone's mental health is off. You know, and they get home and the only option for them is self-harm. That is a deep concern for me, and that overflows. Not just in here, happens in the community now, Meaty. Yeah. You know, like, I think last week in Brisbane, a young girl committed suicide for online bullying. Yeah. So I think it's got to be raised in a topic we'll speak about, especially, you know, in Papua New Guinea and, you know, in the Pacific region.
Yeah. That's, you know, powerful advice, Walshy. You know, I appreciate your time. It's great to hear your story, and I appreciate your time today. So you're a great man. Thanks, Walshy.
Thanks, buddy. Appreciate it.
If you've enjoyed this episode, then I'd love if you would hit that subscribe button, leave a comment or a review, and share it with anyone you think might enjoy it as well. For more behind-the-scenes content, head to my Instagram at davidmead411 and feel free to slide into my DMs if there's anyone you would love to hear from. I can't wait to bring you another episode next week, and thanks for listening to the David Mead Podcast.